Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 7th, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call to recap the oral argument of the Supreme Court case Salmon v. United States. My name is Laura Flint. I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call and not their employer or the Federalist Society. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome our expert, Todd F. Bronstein, Global Head of Legal Investigations at Willis Towers Watson and a former federal prosecutor with experience with insider trading cases. After our speaker makes his opening remarks, we will open the floor for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Todd, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So in recent years, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York has famously undertaken a wave of insider trading prosecutions. In the five-year period between 2009 and mid-2014, the SDNY netted some 85 insider trading convictions without a single loss. At the end of 2014, however, the Second Circuit put a dent in the ability of SDNY and other prosecutors in that circuit to pursue insider trading. In the case United States versus Newman, the Second Circuit adopted a relatively narrow interpretation of the so-called personal benefit element of insider trading. The effect of that decision was to make it much harder to prosecute tippers of confidential information as well as the tippees who trade on it. At the time, Newman was widely seen as a groundbreaking decision that could have a significant impact on the ability to prosecute insider trading in the nation's financial capital and potentially around the country if it was adopted more broadly. Indeed, when the Supreme Court declined to review Newman in October 2015, the SDNY was forced to dismiss convictions or drop pending charges against about a dozen defendants. But just 3 months after denying certiorari in Newman, the Supreme Court decided to take up a different case that raised the same issue, namely the contours of the personal benefit requirement. This was a case out of the Ninth Circuit named Salmon versus United States, and on Wednesday, the court heard oral argument in Salmon. I'll provide some background on the case and then discuss what happened in court. So there's no statute explicitly prohibiting insider trading, much less defining its contours. Instead, when the government goes after insider trading, it uses a variety of more general statutes. The most notable of these, most frequently used of these, is Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which is a general ban on the use of, quote, manipulative or deceptive devices or contrivances in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. And that language obviously doesn't provide much guidance on issues like who counts as an insider and when you can trade on material non-public information. So instead, the answers to those questions have been developed in the courts. And as a result, the law of insider trading is really very much judge-made. As the Supreme Court has developed the law, it is affirmed repeatedly that there is no general ban on trading when you're in possession of material non-public information. Instead, the requirement that an individual disclose the material non-public information that he has or abstain from trading arises only when there is some independent fiduciary duty that would require such a disclosure. And of course, the key example of that is the fiduciary duty that an officer at a securities issuer owes to the shareholders, people who are tipped about inside information don't typically have that type of fiduciary duty. They don't generally have a role in the corporation, and so they don't have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders. That said, the Supreme Court has recognized the need for some type of restriction on tippee trading, at least in some circumstances. And in defining those circumstances, what the court has done is said that really wrongdoing by a tippee has to be derivative of wrongdoing by the original insider who provided the tip. In other words, the tippee may be liable only if he's a participant after the fact in the insider's breach of a fiduciary duty in disclosing information. In a 1983 case called Dirks versus SEC, the court provided some definition as to when a disclosure of inside information constitutes a breach of duty. And the court held that the test is whether the insider receives some personal benefit from disclosing inside information. And the court, in that opinion, went on to give some examples of what might qualify as a personal benefit. The clearest one is a pecuniary gain, such as a kickback, or if he splits the profits from trading with a tippee. Another example the court gave was a reputational benefit that might translate in the future into earnings. And a third example that the Dirks court gave, which is really at the heart of the Salmon case, is when an insider, quote, makes a gift of confidential information to a trading relative or friend, close quote. The court went on to say that that providing such a tip and then the subsequent trading would resemble trading by the insider himself, followed by the gift of profits to the recipient. And then at the end of the opinion, when the court was summing up its holding, the court repeated the gift language by stating that in that case, the tippers received no monetary or personal benefit, nor was their purpose to make a gift of valuable information to the tippee. Dirks was actually the last Supreme Court case to address tippee liability, and over the next 33 years, the government has emphasized this gift language from Dirks when prosecuting defendants where there was no obvious pecuniary gain to the tip, especially tips to close friends and family. But as I mentioned earlier, it was the Newman Court imposed a limit on how far the government could push this language. And Newman's specific holding was that the personal benefit may be inferred from a personal relationship between the tipper and the tippee only when there's a, quote, meaningfully close personal relationship that generates an exchange that is objective, consequential, and represents at least a potential gain of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature. In other words, evidence of a relationship that suggests a quid pro quo or an intention to benefit the recipient. In the Salmon case, argued on Wednesday, the facts at least arguably place it outside the test for liability set forth in Newman. In that case, the insider was a Citigroup banker named Meher Kara, and he provided inside information to his older brother, Michael. Michael, in turn, passed the information on to the petitioner, Salmon, who was a member of their extended family, and both Michael and Salmon traded on the information. At Salmon's trial, there wasn't any evidence generated that Meher had any pecuniary reason for providing the tips to his brother. Instead, it was a variety of personal issues to get his brother's help in understanding the healthcare industry, to provide information that might help their father. Later on, Michael began badgering his brother for inside information, and so Meher disclosed it to get his brother off his back. And then one day, Meher wasn't feeling very well and asked for it for some information. And I'm sorry, Michael wasn't feeling very well, and Meher asked for information, and Meher gave it to him and then regretted it and said and begged his brother not to trade. The district court instructed the jury using language resembling the passage in Dirks about gifts. What the court said is that the jury needed to conclude that Meher had received a personal benefit, which could include the benefit one would obtain from simply making a gift of confidential information to a trading relative or friend. Salmon was convicted, and he lost his appeal when the Ninth Circuit rejected the Newman his Newman-based argument and then successfully petitioned for certiorari. In the Supreme Court, Salmon's argument was that the personal benefit standard set out in Dirks should be limited to the situation where the insider could expect some pecuniary gain. And when advancing this theory, Salmon really tried to draw on some themes that have been successful in recent years for those appealing criminal convictions in the Supreme Court. In particular, in a series of high-profile cases over the last few years, the court has rejected the government's efforts to impose broad constructions on criminal statutes where the language is fairly vague or indeterminate. Leading example of this is Skilling versus United States in 2010, which where the court imposed a narrow construction on the so-called honest services fraud statute. It held that that crime could only be limited to cases involving bribes or kickbacks. And then just last term, in McDonald versus United States, the court gave it a narrow construction to the federal bribery statute in a unanimous opinion, held that a public official doesn't engage in official acts when the public official is just setting up meetings or hosting events or contacting other officials without doing anything beyond that. Solomon in the Supreme Court said that a narrow reading is even more appropriate for insider trading because there is no underlying statute to interpret. It's a crime whose contours are dictated entirely by the judiciary. And so to address the concern that judges are rather than legislators are creating the crime, Solomon argued the court should limit insider trade to its core, which is when the insider abuses confidential information for personal profit. Solomon also emphasized language in the Supreme Court cases that not all trading on material non-public information is actionable. And given that, Solomon said that really pecuniary gain standard is the only way to draw the line that doesn't lead to vagueness problems. He argued that if gifts of information are included, are covered by the insider trading statute, insider trading liability, then the personal benefit could only be the tipper's psychic gratification, his good feelings from providing a generous gift to a friend or family member. And Solomon argued that type of benefit is just impermissibly vague to impose criminal liability. The government, in its response, tried to sidestep those vagueness concerns by proposing that the personal benefit test was really tantamount to personal purpose as opposed to corporate purpose. In other words, insiders are given information in their capacity as corporate insiders to pursue corporate purposes, and when they disclose that information for some kind of personal purpose, trading on that tip would be illegal. The government emphasized, arguing against Solomon's pecuniary gain test, emphasized that Dirks mentioned gifts specifically multiple times and that the pecuniary gain test did not take account of that, and emphasized as well that those references to gifts really they weren't an accident because gifts do offer personal benefits. If you give a gift of information, it can save you money that you might have had to give otherwise. If for example, if you have a relative who's in dire straits and needs some help, rather than giving him money, you can give him a stock tip. The person can trade, and that might save the tipper some money. In addition, of course, there are reputational benefits and others that might accrue for a tipper just giving a gift of confidential information. And the government also spent a good amount of time emphasizing the undesirable policy consequences that the pecuniary gain test would create. In particular, that test would allow insiders to tip their family members and their close friends, who could then trade on inside information and reap significant profits without any concern about liability. This would, in effect, create a small class of privileged investors who had access to information from corporate insiders and could trade on it. And the large majority of stock traders would not have access to that and would be left out in the cold. At oral argument on Wednesday, all signs really seemed to favor the government and that the government would win this particular case. When they were questioning Solomon's attorney, the four liberal justices plus Justice Kennedy all signaled their disagreements with Solomon's position to one degree or another. And when they were questioning the government, it was really notable that there was not a single justice that picked up on Salmon's core arguments about the lack of a clear statutory definitions for insider trading and the analogies to Skilling and McDonnell and the other recent criminal cases. And nor did the justices pick up on Salmon's theme that the government's position might create uncertainty or indefiniteness. In fact, the contrary was true because a couple of justices expressed their concern that it was Salmon that would be creating uncertainty by really upsetting what they regarded as a 30-year consensus understanding of Dirks. So, of course, Salmon's counsel was first up, and right out of the box, Justice Ginsburg questioned the wisdom of Salmon's position that the law should permit gifts of confidential information but prohibit its functional equivalent, which is an insider basically making the trade himself and then gifting the profits to a friend or family member. It also didn't take long, of course, for Justice Kagan begin quoting, to recite the gift language from Dirks. Salmon's lawyer, of course, attempted to downplay that as saying, you know, the opinion just mentioned it once or twice, but Justice Kagan said it was a lot more than that. It was a part of the holding of Dirks. Salmon's lawyer tried to say that it was dictum, it wasn't necessary to decide the case, which is true enough, but Justice Kagan viewed it as the court really setting forth a test as to what would constitute a personal benefit and describing gifts as being part of that test. Justice Kennedy agreed with that. He asserted that Dirks had treated making a gift as a personal benefit, and he suggested he agreed with that. He added that making a gift, particularly or at least in the context of family members, is ennobling and therefore does provide a personal benefit. Justice Sotomayor disagreed somewhat sharply with Salmon's view or argument that the law doesn't really define insider trading. She said that the law establishes general standards and that they've been interpreted for ages as requiring insiders to disclose or abstain. And she said she didn't really understand why Salmon kept saying that the law doesn't define what insider trading is. Justice Breyer drew an analogy to antitrust law, another statute that's fairly general and somewhat vague, but has been developed over the decades, and of course imposes criminal liability. Justice Breyer also commented that virtually every court has held that insider trading covers tippers who give inside information to a close relative, and adopting the new the standard proposed by Salmon would upset settled expectations and change a law that people really rely upon. Justice Kagan raised a similar point a bit later on. She said that Salmon was really asking the court to overturn a 30-year rule that people understood and have lived by, and Congress has amended the securities laws a number of times since then and hasn't indicated any unhappiness with it, and said that she echoed the government's theme that the Dirks rule about gifts helps protect the integrity of the nation's securities markets. Questioning of the government was really a lot less overtly skeptical. The main issue that the justices really tried to tease out was whether the court could or even should draw a line between the gifts of information that are specifically mentioned in Dirks, in other words, gifts of information to friends and family, and gifts to mere acquaintances, and which of course are not mentioned, and where the personal benefit to the insider isn't quite so obvious. Justices Breyer, Alito, and Kagan all asked questions that raise this concept to one degree or another. The government attorney, Michael Dreeben, he really resisted attempts to be drawn into accepting that distinction. He said that the test shouldn't depend on the identity of the recipient. It should be, it it's defined with regard to the breach of the duty of loyalty, and where there is a breach of the duty of loyalty and an understanding on the part of the tipper that the tippee will trade or expects that they'll trade, that there should be liability, and it shouldn't depend on the precise nature of the personal relationship. Towards the end, though, after being pressed on this for a big chunk of the argument, Dreeben, he did eventually say that the government would be fine with a rule that limited tippee liability to friends and family, since that is the situation that arises the most in the real world. And so that is one possible way that this could come out. Chief Justice Roberts asked about somebody who slips up and inadvertently discloses inside information to some friends, and Dreeben responded that's a breach of the duty of confidentiality, not a breach of the duty of loyalty, at least if there's not, if the insider is not providing the information for personal advantage to benefit himself or someone else, with the understanding that the individual, the tippee, will trade. The Chief Justice asked whether the line between those two things wasn't hazy, but Dreeben disagreed and said that the government always bears the burden of proving that the information is given for the purpose of trading and is a breach of fiduciary duty. So all in all, it seems that the court is certainly going to rule for the government by a pretty comfortable margin, suggesting a number of the justices suggested that gifts of confidential information to friends and family should be actionable, and certainly quite probable that gifts may be actionable regardless of recipient. The court may go even farther and just say and adopt the government standard that breach of duty of loyalty plus expectation of trading is actionable. And if it does that, it'll return the law to how many, if not most, understood it before Newman, and Newman itself will then be remembered as a mere temporary detour in the evolution of insider trading law.
All right. If we're ready for questions, I'll now open the floor. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. And while we wait for that first question, I thought I'd ask a question of my own, which is, how did Justice Scalia's absence affect the oral argument? And if he had been on the court, what would have changed?
It's a really good question. This case really raised a number of themes that Justice Scalia that were important to Justice Scalia. And in fact, Solomon's brief really almost seemed as if it was pitched to Justice Scalia. It was written several months after he passed away, but it emphasized a lot of themes. The fact that crimes can only be created by the legislature. Justice Scalia would have been skeptical about interpreting a judge-made crime broadly. And of course, Solomon really emphasized the Skilling case and other cases where the court really cabined criminal statutes that were viewed as vague, and Justice Scalia, this was a significant cause for Justice Scalia. He was a leading advocate in the Skilling case, he would have gone farther than the court did. He would have struck down the honest services fraud statute, and then of course he waged a long battle on the Armed Career Criminal Act, last year he. The court struck down as unconstitutionally vague as well. These are all themes that Justice Scalia may have resonated with Justice Scalia, and being active in oral argument as he was, certainly could have changed the tenor of the discussion and perhaps given Solomon another vote.
Just a reminder, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, I'll just make a brief scheduling announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be on Wednesday, October 12th at 12 noon. We will host a conversation with Danielle Farber, Kristen Hickman, Jim Tozzi, and Adam White on the question of how administrative law should be taught today. Keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, and you can consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website. And please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you might have missed. There's a final call for questions. Please enter star, then the pound key. But not seeing any. Todd, do you have any closing remarks?
No, nothing further beyond what I just beyond what I've said already.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Todd Bronstein for joining us today, and we welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next Teleforum, Wednesday, October 12th at 12 noon, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.